You're listening to the Tipton Children Podcast.
So we'll start with setting our motivation for the evening. As I've been sitting here, I've been thinking about some proofreading I've been doing of some books Venable's working on, and how important it is to be around people that are supportive to our practice of the Dharma. You can just watch when something triggers you and your mind gets really unruly. If you were around people who supported your afflictions, it would just help you to cement them in your mind. Whereas if you're around people who understand, you know, that these are transitory and actually deluded, they can help you to see your own delusions, and then they don't become so concrete in the mind. And if we never have this view at all, that to question our thoughts and our perceptions, then we will just see the world as the appearances, they will seem so real. We would never doubt our perceptions, our thoughts about things. Maybe we'd figure out our thoughts would change a lot, but our perceptions we'd probably hold on to pretty strongly. And we would just remain lost. So I feel a lot of a gratitude to my friends here in this room and my Dharma friends here and there, as well as, of course, our teachers and the Buddha's teachings. So tonight, as we explore Nagarjuna's text, let's remember the kindness of all of these Dharma practitioners that have preceded us for thousands of years, preserving these words, helping us to understand them, all with the purpose of benefiting beings. So may we turn our minds in that direction too, seeing our potential always to be able to overcome the adversities in our mind, the afflictions in our mind. Kinzer Wangdok once said that the sign of Buddhahood is that the nature of the mind is clear and knowing. So this is helping us to realize our great potential. So let's keep that in mind and let that influence how we spend our time tonight, and have this be one step along our path to full awakening, in order to benefit all beings, remove all beings from every suffering. So we usually have worked on quizzes when Venerable Children was gone, but this time we're taking a little vacation from the quizzes, and we're going to focus on the last, probably third or more, of chapter 4 in Nagarjuna's Precious Garland. And this is where he's presenting what is called a reasoned analysis to prove the authenticity of the Mahayana scriptures. And this is actually something that has been an issue of controversy for millennia. Are the Mahayana scriptures actually the word of the Buddha? And when Venerable was teaching this, I was not, it took me a long time to, at first, I didn't really work for me, let's put it that way. the reasoning didn't work. I just thought this seems kind of weak and parts of it. And then I thought, well, that's the question I want to go to here, because why was that? And before I even pulled out the books or anything, I thought about this for a long time. And one thing I realized is that about 15 years ago, maybe 15, 17 years ago, I had some friends of mine, a friend of a friend was a Western nun in the Hindu tradition. And I remember she was a Sanskrit scholar and getting her PhD in Indiana. And I was, I can't remember if this is before, or after I met Venerable Children, actually, which was in 2000. But at any rate, I remember her, maybe it was after then, because I had been reading about Buddhism since I was young, and I was first in college, I was a comparative religions major, undeclared, but I was studying religions and philosophy before I went into the sciences. And so I was really surprised what she said to me. She said that at the university she was at, the professors were actually doubting if the Tibetan Buddhism, what the Vajrayana, was even Buddhist, and if the Mahayana was a part of Buddhism either, I think. You know, something really is like, I was just like, really? You know, and so, and this is not a new question. This has been a question from early, early on, and this is what Nagarjuna is addressing in this chapter. So as I thought about this, I'm walking around doing things here, I realized that I was thinking about things that Gaia taught us and this and that, and this is what leads to this presentation tonight. And so it's really one for asking questions, and maybe it's going to be a little bit more like how Jeffrey teaches than how we usually do these evenings. So I welcome you to, in the room here, people that are listening, to join in, okay, to the thought process. And the way I want to do this is I want to use the outline extensively that goes with this part of the chapter. And that was written by Gelsopje, who was Lama Tsongkhapa's student. And the Tibetans have this really helpful practice of making outlines of these great texts. And if you haven't noticed in this text, it goes back and forth between these different topics, and you're sometimes wondering exactly what they're doing. And so this is exactly why he wrote this outline. It helped, according to, I think it was Jeffrey who talked about this, because Jeffrey Hopkins wrote a book about the Precious Garland with his commentary, also with the translation of the root text, and then I guess maybe it's Gelsopje's commentary or something, but he also had his own commentary in there. So you've got all three of these happening in this text, and we're going to get into some of that tonight. But he talks about they did this outline to help to clarify these shifts of topics that happen. And I learned a couple of years ago that sometimes it's really hard to understand these texts without the outlines, and that the outlines really lead you to these central points that help you to understand what they're trying to say. And I find that, so that's what I've been doing, is kind of looking at this outline a lot and trying to understand what's happening in this text, in this part of the text in particular. So we're in chapter 4, which is advice to train in flawless policy. That's the title of the chapter. And it starts with some verses about where they transition, and then it goes into this extensive exposition on flawless policy, which is almost all of the verses in the chapters, like 307 to 398. So you might remember that they talked about royal policies, remember all the things about building gardens and roads and da-da-da-da-da. That was the first part, and then that was verse 307 to 327. But then it went into this part on instruction in non-degeneration and development, and that was up to verse 335, and there they were talking about, you know, things like having good ministers, making yourself compassionate, freeing or banishing prisoners, it was a lot to do with the king, still about what the king should be doing. So that takes you through, you know, the first third of the, or more, actually the first half of that chapter. Then you get into this section called Achieving Liberation and Not Forsaking the Scriptures of the Great Vehicle, which is verse 346, almost to the end, to 398. So I'm kind of trying to lay out where we're at and how we got there, you know. So how even Venerable Simke was asking me about this today when I told her I was going to teach about this chapter. She was like, how did he put this part of this in this chapter? What did that have to do with, what does this have to do with royal policy, you know? And that we can think about. That's not the question I really have. My question is the part about accepting the Mahayana scriptures as the word of the Buddha. Okay, so when Nagarjuna writes this part, Achieving Liberation and Not Forsaking the Scriptures of the Great Vehicle, he first talks about training in the path to liberation. And I'm just going through the outline here. This is in the back of Jeffrey's book, Buddhist Advice for Living and Liberation. It's so there's, you know, and I'm happy to send you my notes if you want to just listen. So training in the path of liberation. And even so, right there at the beginning, you know, he's talking about not forsaking the scriptures of the great vehicle. The first topic is training in the path of liberation. And even there, I think from the beginning, my thought is that he's trying to show some kind of commonality between these, the fundamental vehicle and the Mahayana. So the first thing he spends about 20-some verses on, and you might remember this part, is where we're trying to refute inherently existent object of attachment and work with pleasant and unpleasant feelings. Maybe you remember all that that we went through, right? Okay, then we get into the meat of the issue that I'm interested in tonight, which is the next item under this outline. Both lesser vehicle practitioners and great vehicle practitioners equally realize the subtle emptiness. And this is verse 365 and 366. And this, to me, just foreshadowing the evening, to me, this is the crux of the proof in my mind. So, you know, I'm asking you to think about, you know, what we've been learning about and see what you think. But for me, that seems to, this is the real issue. And that has parts about how it's necessary to realize this subtle emptiness to achieve liberation, and then talks about the differences between the lesser vehicle and the greater vehicle, mainly the idea being there that bodhisattvas remain in the world out of compassion. So that kind of sets up the basic format of what happens in that first part, and we'll come back to that. Where I got hung up was more in this next part, which is goes into this part. It starts with stopping forsaking the scriptures of the great vehicle, 367 through 398. So the first part is this extensive exposition. First is the reason for the unsuitability of forsaking the great vehicle scriptures. And for me, it was interesting that he used the word forsaking. And this was the part, I'll go through this just to remind you, you know, the verses that we were talking about. It's first, it goes over the faults of deriding the great vehicle. And so I was asking myself, why did Nagarjuna start with this? You know, and it turns out that here he's essentially, this section is showing the disadvantages of deriding the Mahayana. But for me, I was thinking, why do they use the word forsaking? I guess I was trying to figure out at this point, who is his audience? As I read all through this, I was thinking, who is his audience? So let me just read these first few verses. The first of these is 367, where the showing how the great vehicle is derided. That's what the outline says. So it says, the Tathagata has taught the Bodhisattvas collections of merit and wisdom in the universal vehicle, or the Mahayana. But it is derided by those who are confused and antagonistic. And then it talks about the reasons for this derision that they have, their antagonism and all. And that's what the next two verses are on, 368 and 369. Those who would deride the universal vehicle either cannot distinguish good qualities from faults, or they mistake good qualities for faults, or else they despise good qualities. What harms others are faults. What helps them are good qualities. Recognizing this, it is said that those who deride the universal vehicle dislike good qualities. So this is the reasoning that Nagarjuna is stating here. And then he goes into the faults of deriding the great vehicle. And I'll read those verses, which is the next two, 370 and 371. By being unconcerned about one's own aims, one takes delight uniquely in the aims of others. This source of all good qualities is the teaching of the universal vehicle. Hence, one who disparages it is tormented by unfortunate rebirths. Even a faithful person is tormented due to misunderstanding it. Someone else who is hostile is tormented due to his animosity. So here he's bringing up, like, wow, someone who's faithful is tormented due to their misunderstanding. That's probably most of us. And someone else who is hostile is tormented due to his animosity towards these teachings. If it is said that even the faithful person is tormented, what about one who is hostile? So as I was thinking about this, I was thinking, well, who's the audience there? It's certainly not non-Buddhists. You know, I mean, to me, what we learned about Nagarjuna is that he was in the monasteries, and there was no separation at that time with people who were practicing in the Mahayana and the fundamental vehicle, and it wasn't maybe even so well defined as such. And I think just as this text, as you read through and read through, it starts to make more and more sense. I think some of the things that I'm saying now will make more sense at the end. Kind of laying the groundwork. And I think that's why I sometimes don't follow this text, because it's kind of building to a, I find that it's building to a point, and it's just taking you a little bit of the time. Same thing in Aryadeva's 400. It seems like to really understand a point, it's leading you, and you're like, where are we going? And then it finally gets there. And I find that to be a little bit the case, the style of it. Just seems like that to me. Maybe that's part of the reason why I had trouble with this. So we'll just kind of go through this still of where this comes up, and then it'll be quite clear where I kind of fell away because it wasn't working. So next part of this, the outline says, therefore the unsuitability of despising the great vehicle. So they spend seven verses on that. And this is where they went into the topics of the elimination of great suffering through a little suffering. And that was the idea of how a physician uses a little bit of suffering to eliminate something that's unhelpful. Like you have to, surgery is not, you know, involves suffering, but you're getting rid of a huge problem, usually, or even a small problem. And so then the next verse goes on, though there is a little suffering in the deeds of the great vehicle, it's unsuitable to despise what completely eliminates suffering. So in my mind, at this point, let me read these two verses and see what you think. I felt like this is what Guy Newland had told us, and it seemed like this is what's happening here. Nagarjuna is in the monastery with all, you know, different kinds of practitioners, and he has to find like a shared reality in the Dharma, you know, to make his point. And also just worldly common sense. And that's what I think these next verses do. So the first one, 373, says, the scriptures maintain the mind is the prerequisite for all dharmas. The mind is the principal factor in karma. Doesn't that sound like the Dhammapada? Which is well accepted, right? So if one does something helpful with the intention to be helpful, how could it be unhelpful even if suffering is involved? So right there, in my mind, he's taking a shared view in the Dharma, where they have the same worldly view, and then he's using it to help to explain the Mahayana. And then the next verse to me is just kind of common, worldly common sense, or where he says, if one does something unpleasant that will later be unhelpful, if someone does something unpleasant that will later be helpful, then what about doing something for oneself and for others that is both pleasant and helpful? this is an ancient principle. So he's just making a call to common sense, in a way, worldly common sense. And he's using shared, in my mind, shared worldviews to try to introduce to people that are already Buddhist, I think. Let's see what you think. So then he goes on that it's the right, the outline says, the rightness of making effort for the sake of great bliss and the wrongness of being attached to small pleasures. So again, I don't know that these verses would work for a non-Buddhist. What do you think? Here, this is the next three verses. It says, if one will later attain great happiness from forsaking some trivial pleasure now, then a sensible person realizing that she will gain great happiness should abandon that trifling pleasure now. Okay, maybe a non-Buddhist would go with that too. If you cannot bear this, then healers and such who prescribe bitter medicine would disappear, and that makes no sense. But now this is the part I think that he's really talking to his fellow monastics. The wise see that in some cases what is usually harmful can be helpful. All treatises propose both general rules and exceptions. So that's kind of saying that in general it's true that suffering is to be abandoned, but there are exceptions when this isn't the case. And that's essentially what the problem that some of these folks were having, like, hey, you're asking me to give up my body? You're asking me to deal with these people? You know, things like that. You know, and they're, so, you know, this is trying to, the point is that even the treatises and commentaries always present a general situation as well as exceptions. And all these monastics would have known that from knowing their own scriptures that they accepted. And I also think this is helpful just in the monastic community. When you meet different monastics, you'll notice that some are really more comfortable with very literal views of everything, and some take more expansive views of things, and people have different dispositions. And so I think he's actually, in a way, could be trying to tell people who are quite literal and that, hey, yes, things are prescribed, but there always are exceptions. You know, we see that in terms of how the Vinaya is followed around the Buddhist world. So to me, that's like really speaking to monastics when he's writing this. Then he goes on to verse 378, where he talks the suitability of liking the great vehicle. So now he's kind of trying, he's made all these cases about, you know, why you shouldn't reject it, the disadvantages, and now he's kind of giving the advantages a little more, why it's suitable. And he says, the universal vehicle says that all activities should be motivated by compassion, and that wisdom will make them pure. What sensible person would deride this? And then it summarizes in the next verse by saying, discouraged by its vastness and profundity, ignorant persons, due to their confusion, today deride the universal vehicle and thus become the foes of themselves and others. So my question to you is, from what you've heard so far, who do you think he's talking to? Would that make sense? Like, if you were in a non-Buddhist tradition, what he has said there, would that make you believe that the Mahayana was the Buddha's words? Or if you were a university professor in modern days, non-Buddhist again, you know, an academic Buddhist religious studies teacher, would what you've heard be, does it sound like it's speaking to you? I don't really think so. I think he's really talking to the monastics here, talking to Buddhist monastics. And I, you know, it'd be interesting, you know, when the Buddha was teaching, there were many, many non-Buddhists, and so the things were said in a certain way. And then when the Tibetans that we read were teaching, they were talking generally to all Buddhist audience. So the things were said in a certain way, you know. So the audience, I think, makes a difference. And that's, I think, why I had trouble with this next part. And this is the part that really was like, because the next part is now, we've gone through the part above, which is about the reason for the unsuitability for forsaking the great vehicle scriptures. And even the word forsaking, if you're forsaking something, doesn't it have to be something that you are a part of, that then you're letting go of? You know, so I think he has to be talking to Buddhists. This is my own thoughts. Okay, so now it's the next part of this outline where he moves into this proving that the great vehicle scriptures are the word of the Buddha. And this is maybe about 10 verses, I guess, this part of it. And he first part talks about the deeds of the six perfections, verse 380 through 382. In verse 380, the outline says, not the slightest bad explanation in the scriptures of the great vehicle. And that verse is this. The nature of what the universal vehicle maintains is generosity, ethical conduct, fortitude, joyous effort, meditative stability, wisdom, and compassion. How could it contain a wrong statement? And then the next verse, the outline says the aims of the great vehicle are taught in great vehicle scriptures. So the next couple of verses are, others' aims are achieved through generosity and ethical conduct, our own through fortitude and joyous effort, and meditative stability and wisdom lead to liberation. This summarizes the universal vehicle teachings. So he's just gone over the six perfections and laid them out and who they're for. And this is the verse that I just kind of like, this would not prove it for me. So then he says, in brief, the teaching of the Buddha includes what benefits oneself and others and the way to attain liberation. These topics are contained in the six perfections. Therefore, they are also the Buddha's words. This is where I didn't realize why I felt this was such a weak statement until I thought about I had in the back of my mind the statement from decades ago, you know, and I was thinking, these people don't even believe, you know, how they had the idea in Tibet that it was Lamaism. This is something as holiness is always kind of trying to make clear, hey, this is Buddhism. Because for the first understanding that outsiders had of Buddhism in Tibet, they had it wrong completely. They didn't have any clue about the depth of their philosophy. They just saw things that they didn't understand and they thought it was worshiping teachers, period, you know. So it was way off base. So I'm thinking of that person I know who was telling about the professor who said, well, they're not even Buddhist in Tibet and the Mahayanas aren't even part of Buddhism, right? And I was thinking, in brief, the Buddha's includes what benefits oneself and others and the way to attain liberation. These topics are covered in the six perfections. Therefore, they are also the Buddha's words. That really would fall flat for me unless I was kind of on the inside of it already. That just, for me, that wouldn't work. I'd have to know a lot more. But then, to me, it turns around a little bit. And the next part goes into this thing about verse 383. It's the necessity of knowing the complete path of great enlightenment from the great vehicle scriptures. And it says, those blinded by ignorance cannot tolerate the universal vehicle in which the Buddha taught the great path, consisting of merit and wisdom that leads to awakening. And now this is going to unfold in the next verses. The next part is the necessity of knowing the great nature of a Buddha from the great vehicle, which therefore is the word of the Buddha. And to me, this starts really to make more sense because verse 384 and 385 are about the limitless causes of the form body of a Buddha. And these are explained in the Great Vehicle. They're actually not explained in the Fundamental Vehicle because what was laid out there was more how to become an arhat. And of course, we know that they had bodhisattvas. They had the recognition of bodhisattvas and the three vehicles are presented. They had the belief in Buddhas, obviously, but Buddhas they knew weren't arhats. That's all how, you know, but what was really taught was how to become an arhat, right? Things weren't taught extensively there. And it wasn't actually taught in those scriptures, the limitless causes of a form body. And according to His Holiness, those are actually only fully explained in highest class Tantra. So, to me, this starts to make the reasoning a lot stronger, because that canon is showing you the way to become an arhat, the Pali canon, but it didn't give you how to become a Buddha. Well, there are Buddhas, and they accept there are Buddhas, so there must be a way to become one, right? So that right there starts to get a little bit stronger in my mind. Here's the next couple of verses. Since a victor comes from merit that is inconceivable as space, a victor is said to have inconceivable good qualities. Hence, one should accept the greatness of Buddhas as explained in the universal vehicle. And then it goes on, just as the ethical conduct of the Buddha was beyond Sariputta's ken, Sariputta couldn't understand that, then why wouldn't one accept that the greatness of the Buddhas is inconceivable? So then here Khenzer Wangdak told the story about at the time of the Buddha actually asked Sariputta, who was an arhat, if he could understand one quality of the Buddha, the Buddha's ethical conduct. And Sariputta replied that he couldn't fathom it at all. The Buddha's qualities were so subtle and difficult to understand, not visible to sentient beings. He couldn't understand even that one quality of the Buddha. So I'm kind of assuming that the reason Nagarjuna wrote this is that this was a shared story that everyone would have known. And so he's saying, you know, he's kind of pointing out, hey, even Sariputta, it was inconceivable, even one quality of the Buddha. So maybe, you know, we can accept here what it says in this verse, since a victor comes from merit that is inconceivable as space, the victor is said to have inconceivable good qualities. So right there he's really enhancing the need for merit to become a Buddha, which is not what you find in, you know, in the Pali Canon. This will come more later, but that kind of goes back to those six perfections and the two wings of the bird, how you need merit and wisdom to become a Buddha. So then Khenzer Wangdak explained this a little bit more, and I think that this is helpful to understand this aspect of things. And we've been learning about this, but I never realized until studying this week that Nagarjuna brought this point out, and this is that let's use the right words here, followers of the lower tenet schools, right? That would be Vaibhashika and Satantrika, right? He's saying, Khenzer Jampa Tekchot is saying, and this is just explaining Nagarjuna, what Nagarjuna is saying, those followers of those tenets don't understand that full awakening arises from the vast collections of merit and wisdom. And they don't understand that the collection of wisdom is accumulated by meditating on the emptiness of inherent existence of persons and phenomena. And this is all this and more is explained in the Universal Vehicle Scriptures. So some of the practitioners, some of the Buddhists, were rejecting these teachings of the Buddha on the emptiness of inherent existence, saying that liberation is attained by realizing the Four Noble Truths. And that's the main thing that you meditate on if you remember in our study of tenets, that in Satantrika, the main thing you meditate on is the Four Noble Truths. So they assert that realizing the lack of a self-sufficient, substantially existent person is the selflessness of person. And some of these schools, like the Vaibhashika and the Satantrika, don't assert selflessness of phenomena. And those that do, like the mind only and the Svatantrikas, they also don't assert the lack of inherent existence as the selflessness of both persons and phenomena. So only the Manyamaka are differing in this way, saying that if realizing only the four truths were necessary to attain liberation, why would the Buddha have taught on the emptiness of inherent existence in so many sutras? If there was no selflessness of phenomena, why did the Buddha teach it? So there they're really posing the question. And that sets us up for the verse that we're going to spend a lot of time on, one verse tonight. But I want to back up a little bit, because we're steeped in the view of Lama Tsongkhapa and Tibetan Buddhism in general that shares this. So I think that I'm looking at a lot of this from whose point of view are we coming from here. our point of view is more like this. What do we need to gain insight? Lama Tsongkhapa lays this out quite clearly in the middle length Lam Rim. The view realizing, the generation of the view realizing suchness. Okay, we learn these things by hearing and thinking. And we realize these by using the stainless texts and an independence on scholars who know the essentials of the scriptures. So this is an indispensable prerequisite. If you don't have a view to the fullest extent, if you don't really, let's make it in easier language, the mode, you know, the object of negation, if you don't identify that correctly, you can't liberate yourself from cyclic existence, right? Another way to say that is you have to understand the mode of being a phenomena, which is their emptiness, the emptiness of inherent existence. It would be impossible to have a realization of special insight, realizing the mode of being, the ultimate reality, without realizing what the mode of reality is. You can't liberate yourself without knowing what reality is, how things exist. Every Buddhist agrees with that. And from, you know, what we're marinated in, this view is sought by looking at not the interpretable scriptures, the interpretable meaning, but the definitive meaning. And so it's important to recognize what scriptures are and meanings are definitive and what are interpretable. So in this regard, we're always taught that we need to rely on those valid teachers who opened up the way, who commented on the Buddha's thought. Otherwise, you'll be like a blind person without a guide going in the direction of fright. That's what Lama Tsongkhapa says. And then who should we rely on? The unmistaken commentary on the Buddha's thought is Nagarjuna. That's what Lama Tsongkhapa says. And this actually is, His Holiness has great faith in Nagarjuna. The way His Holiness teaches is right in line with what Lama Tsongkhapa is teaching here in my mind. So, you know, Nagarjuna, from the view, from a Tibetan Buddhist point of view, is renowned in the three worlds. He's the Buddha himself prophesies very clearly in many sutras and tantras that Nagarjuna would unravel the essence of his teaching, the profound emptiness. And so that's who we want to rely on. So that's what we're marinated in, right? That's where we come from when we read this text. But for those in the monastery that Nagarjuna was with, that's not exactly how they were thinking fully, I don't think. So then, what does Nagarjuna have to do? That's where we get into this next verse, 386, where we're going to spend some time. So this is a verse that I couldn't really grok it at all when Venerable taught it. And she didn't spend a long time on it, but it turns out that Jeffrey Hopkins did spend a lot of time on it in his book. So first we're going to go about it a little more generally. So this verse is that one that talked about the outline says, the knowledge of extinction, which was described in the lesser vehicle, and the extinction and no production described in the great vehicle have the same meaning of realizing of the realization of emptiness. So basically what they were saying here, I'll read it the way Venerable Children has it, her translation. The non-arising taught in the universal vehicle and the cessation, in quote, taught for other, quote, Buddhists, are, quote, both, because a lot of brackets are put into these, and everyone does this differently. The non-arising taught in the universal vehicle and the cessation taught for other Buddhas, those are in brackets, are both emptiness. Therefore, one should accept that cessation and non-arising are ultimately the same. So her translation ends up being quite, in that text, which was, I'm not sure who translated that. It's different. It's fairly different from Jeffrey's in terms of the last line. The other part's pretty much the same. And then it goes on, emptiness is the majesty of the awakened one. Reflecting thus with reasoning, how could the wise not maintain that what is said in the universal vehicle and the other are equal? So there's just, Nagarjuna's just saying it flat out there. They're the same. They're equal. And what is the same? What's in the verse before, the emptiness. So Kinderjampa Tektro talks about how these are the same. So they're the same. Okay, they're using different words. One is using knowledge of extinction in one translation, and that's the fundamental vehicle. And the other is using teachings on non-arising or non-production. But both of those are meaning emptiness. That's what they're trying to show here, that both of these things are meaning emptiness. So Nagarjuna says that this explanation is based on a fundamental vehicle scripture in which the term extinction refers to primordial extinction of dukkha and the aggregates. That is, the emptiness of inherent existence. Okay, so how do we make that work? And this is what... Where's the problem? Why is it the hearers don't want to accept the universal vehicle? One of the main reasons is that they think that the principal cause for attaining liberation, that as it's explained in the scriptures that they accept, isn't explained in the universal vehicle. So that's why they reject the Mahayana scriptures, because they're not teaching how to get liberated. And what Nagarjuna is trying to say is, yes, they are. And they're trying to say that both of these refer to the realization of emptiness, which is the essential cause of liberation. And for that reason, and this is the big point that I never realized Nagarjuna had before, they should accept that the subtle emptiness is taught in their own scriptures, in their own scriptures. So what he's saying is that they may be followers of the lower tenet systems, Vaibhashika and Satantrika, but so that's their tenets, that's what they believe in, but their actual scriptures teach the emptiness of inherent existence. Because their own scriptures teach this, they should accept the scriptures that are the word of the Buddha. But we've had teachings from Venerable on some other verses by that one Bhikkhuni, who teaches about at least the emptiness of the self, if not the emptiness of phenomena. Guy thought maybe not the emptiness of phenomena was included in that verse. It would depend how you read it. But that's not the verse Nagarjuna is pointing to here. So now we're going to turn to Jeffrey's book and go through how he explains this. Because this is, can you kind of see how this is becoming the crux of the matter? If you can't find the way to be liberated, why would you want to believe in these verses? So you've got to me this ties it together. It's the most salient thing. So Jeffrey analyzed, translated, and edited Precious Garland. Yeah, so here he's got this section about how hearers and bodhisattvas both realize the subtle emptiness. So he's saying right after Nagarjuna gave the analysis of pleasure and pain, like was in those earlier verses, he declares that it's through this realization built on this kind of analysis that beings are liberated from samsara. So he's indicating that not only great vehicle practitioners, but also the hearers, they have to realize the same kind of emptiness. And he says in verse 365 in Jeffrey's translation, knowing thus correctly, just as it is, that transmigrating beings do not exist in fact, one passes from suffering, not subject to rebirth, and hence without appropriating rebirth, like a fire without its cause. So that transmigrating beings do not exist in fact. That's pointing to like their lack of inherent existence. That's what that's kind of trying to do. So he's saying that then later, Nagarjuna also reaffirms this later in the text. And this is now 366. In the next two lines, he said, bodhisattvas also perceive the same reality. Bodhisattvas who also have seen it thus seek perfect enlightenment with certainty. And then he goes back and Jeffrey mentions that, hey, in chapter 1, Nagarjuna brought this up too. He said, and this is a very famous verse, as long as the aggregates are conceived, this is verse 35, as long as the aggregates are conceived, so long thereby does the conception of I exist. Further, when the conception of I exists, there is action, and from it there is also birth. So right there, showing how the conception of inherent existence ignorance, essentially, leads to action, leads to rebirth. So, earlier in the text, Nagarjuna has already pointed out that both hearers and bodhisattvas have to realize that all phenomena, not just persons, do not inherently exist. And how do we know that? Because aggregates are phenomena. That's what he's saying in that verse. As long as the aggregates are conceived, so until we realize the emptiness of inherent existence of the aggregates of phenomena, which is not what they usually work on, right, in the two lower tenet systems. It's just the selfness as a person that they address. And then later in this verse, 386, the one that we're really trying to understand here, which might put you all to sleep. This is not so easy to understand, and I don't understand it fully, but I still am going to try to present it. As Jeffrey says, this is a very cryptic stanza. So he's trying to point out that extinction taught in the lower vehicle is the same as the absence of production or non-arising taught in the great vehicle. So because it was, here's the way Jeffrey translated that. It was different from how we first read it. Jeffrey translates that verse as the absence of production taught in the great vehicle and the extinction of the others, which is the lower vehicle, are in fact the same emptiness. Since they indicate the non-existence of inherently existent production and the extinction of inherent existence, therefore let the great vehicle be allowed is the Buddha's word. So he's trying to tie those two things together. Is everybody following this kind of a little bit? Okay. You were there the first time, so. Okay, so now, because it's so cryptic, Jeffrey pulls out both Lama Tsongkhapa and Gelsop J's commentaries. And there's more on this, but I am only giving like a part of this to try to just present the idea in brief, as brief as I can. So Tsongkhapa gives kind of a four or five part explanation of this. He stages this. First, he repeats what Nagarjuna says, but he puts it in an easier way to understand. And what he says is this. Just this meaning of the absence of inherent existence of phenomena is taught in the scriptural divisions of the lower vehicle. Straight out. The absence of inherent existence of phenomena is taught essentially in the Pali Canon, is what he's saying. And he's going to say the verse that I just read, he states. But then he restates it, or maybe it's Jeffrey doing this. He's retranslating it with Lama Tsongkhapa's explanation. And it comes out as this. The teaching of emptiness in the great vehicle as the absence of production and the other's teaching of emptiness, the hearer vehicle, as extinction are equivalent since they indicate the non-existence of inherently existent production and the extinction of inherent existence. Therefore, let the great vehicle be allowed as the Buddha's word. So, he's saying that this you find this in your own scriptures, right? So then he goes on. So there he brings up what it is, and he says it in somewhat easier words. It just lays it out. Hey, you've got it in your own scriptures. Then he refutes two other explanations of this that he says are, the first one he says is just plain crude. This is one person thought that had interpreted Nagarjuna's point here, this verse, to mean that an absence of inherent existence is a basic requirement for something to become extinct. And I don't understand this fully, but let me just kind of read this part, or else I'll probably screw it up. So Tsongkhapa, from that, draws this absurd conclusion that then any phenomena, such as a sprout, and an emptiness of inherent existence would be equivalent. He's saying that they're equivalent. And so he doesn't explain that further, but basically Jeffrey does, and he says, well, one reason that you could say they aren't equivalent is the sprout is a compounded positive phenomena, and the lack of an emptiness is an uncompounded negative phenomena. It's an absence, right? So how could they be equivalent? They can't be equivalent, because they're one's a positive phenomena, one's a negative phenomena. I mean, right there, they're separate. So then you might think, well, that's kind of odd, because didn't we learn in the Heart Sutra that emptiness is form and form is emptiness? But Tsongkhapa always has an answer. It's not meaning that they're equivalent. That's not, he means that, he says that that means that the entity of a form and its emptiness are the same. It's the entity of form and its emptiness are the same. They're the same entity. This is where, you know, you get into same entity, different conceptual isolates. So that's the thing that we have the hardest time understanding. How can this impermanent phenomena have something permanent about it? One entity, different conceptual isolates. The emptiness of inherent existence is a permanent, negative, you know, phenomena. And this is a positive, impermanent phenomena, and they're one entity. So some people have, that's hard to understand, and this guy had trouble with it too, obviously. So then he also goes on to brush off this other Ajita Mitra, who thought that this absence of production also, he was equating essentially the emptiness of inherent existent production with impermanence, saying those have the same meaning, and that's kind of not really, that means if you realize impermanence, you would realize emptiness. And that doesn't really work either. So he didn't spend much time on those, but he basically he refuted these two misinterpretations of that verse, and then he did it his own reading. And here's kind of the crux of the matter here: like, well, what is this verse that they're talking about, where they got this word extinction from? You know. So then he pulls it out, because it's Chandakirti who identified this verse, and that's why. That's how I guess they understand this. So there's two things, he refutes those, he gives his own reading, and his reading has two things. First, he utilizes Chandakirti's identification of the sutra, and then that sutra, he says, teaches a certain type of extinction that Nagarjuna is talking about in this verse. So this is, if you've ever read the Pali canon, you'll often see verses that talk about extinction, a practitioner achieving a state of release where there'll be no more suffering. So it can't just, but what he's saying is required here, and this is a little bit beyond my capacity to understand fully, but I can read this like a book report. I get it, kind of. Basically, what they have to find here is a passage in the Pali Canon that speaks about the extinction of the mental and physical aggregates in the present time while the practitioner is alive. Not extinction meaning, it has to have that kind of meaning for it to be the same as, somehow to be have the same meaning as the absence of inherent existent production. See, they're tying those two together. They're saying they have the same meaning. Well, how is it they have the same meaning? They had to find this verse, and apparently Chandakirti did. So what is that passage? Chandakirti writes about this when he comments on one of Nagarjuna's texts. And as Jeffrey says, it takes some maneuvering to make it say what he wants. That sounds like Jeffrey. So he split the passage into two parts. And the first part of the passage is referring to extinction of the present suffering, and this is, they need to do it that way to make these things tie together. And maybe we'll understand this more by the time I'm done, but maybe not. We'll just have to take it. Hopefully we'll understand it someday better. So one refers to the extinction of present suffering or the present mental and physical aggregates, and the other is referring to the extinction of future suffering. So he finds that verse. And why does this have to happen this way? Because the main point is that since the first one refers to the extinction of present suffering or the present mental and physical aggregates, so the first one refers to that, it means it doesn't refer to a cessation brought about by the path, meaning it refers to a natural extinction that these phenomena have always had. Oh, this is why. And is seen when perceiving emptiness. Emptiness is there whether you realize it or not, right? So they had to find something that points to that, not somebody who's practiced the path. A natural extinction that these phenomena have always had. Things have always been empty. And is seen when perceiving emptiness. What would that be? Lack of inherent existence. Yeah, that's the answer to this. I finally figured it out. It can't refer to a cessation brought about by the path. Why? Because then it would be just something that somebody had practiced. It has to be something that's always naturally been there to make those two equivalent. The absence of inherent existence has always been there. They have to be talking about a kind of extinction that's always been there. That's the tie. So he found it in this verse, and here's how he did it. This is the verse. The verse says, the first half is the present suffering. Okay. This which is complete abandonment of these sufferings, this is important, this which is complete abandonment of these sufferings, definite abandonment, purification, extinction, separation from desire, cessation, thorough pacification, disappearance, now it shifts, non-connection to other suffering, non-arising and non-production is peace. This is auspicious. It is like this, the definite abandonment of all the aggregates, the extinction of cyclic existence, freedom from desire, cessation, nirvana. It's not unusual to hear verses like this in the Pali Canon. So what he's saying here is this first part where he says, these sufferings, he says this is like a proximate term, these, something that's now, in the present, these sufferings. These are referring to the sufferings that exist presently, or the aggregates that exist presently. And so those words were complete abandonment of these sufferings, definite abandonment, purification, extinction, separation from desire, cessation, thorough pacification, disappearance. So that's referring to a present suffering or a present aggregate. And then the second part of the passage is referring to future suffering. So that part says, non-connection to other suffering, non-arising, non-production is peace. This is auspiciousness. It is like this, the definite abandonment of all the aggregates, the extinction of cyclic existence, freedom from desire, cessation, nirvana. Well, that clearly relates to the path. So maybe he's stretching it, who knows, you know, that's what, maneuvering it, as Jeffrey says. So then Gelsup Jay explains this. And now it goes, you know, for us who have been studying tenets, he kind of explains this in a way that brings in some of that. So what they're having to do here is they're trying to tie together the teachings in the scriptures of the great vehicle on cessation in the, you know, the lack of inherent existent production. They're trying to tie that to the teaching in the fundamental vehicle scriptures that talk about extinction, right? So he says, the proponents of Ahira vehicle tenets assert as the word of the Buddha, they accept these scriptures. Even those, he's trying to tie that point in again of, these are Ahira vehicle tenet holders who aren't understanding their own scriptures. That's what he's trying to point out again here, right? So he says it like this. They have the same meaning. The absence of production and extinction have the same meaning. That is to say, the absence of inherently existent production and the extinction of inherent existence. And knowing this emptiness of inherent existence is the same as knowing the absence of production and knowing extinction. So then consequently, he says, he's just rewording the verse again. You want to accept these great vehicles as the word of the Buddha. Let it be an object of your awareness. So if you use his interpretation, now Jeffrey again retranslates it. I guess it's Jeffrey retranslating the verse using his interpretation. So yeah, it is, because he says, it seems the stanza should be translated in this way. So that's Jeffrey talking. The teaching of the great vehicle of the absence of production and the others teaching of extinction, emptiness, are the same as meaning the absence of inherently existent production and the extinction of inherent existence. Therefore, let the great vehicle be allowed as the Buddha's word. So there, he's just made it completely clear using a lot of brackets, as usual. Okay, so that is the best I could do to explain how they tied those two together. I think I finally made sense of it to myself. Couldn't understand that point. So, do you get the basic point? The basic point is they teach the absence of inherent existence in the Pali Canon, the people who follow that canon don't hold it in their tenet system, the Satantrika and the Vaibhashika. Vaibhashika and Satantrika, they don't talk about absence of inherent existence. That's not how you get liberated. You get rid of a substantially self-sufficient, substantially existent person. That's how you become an arhat, according to their tenets. But according to their scriptures, you can find not only that, but other references that refer to the inherent existence of persons and phenomena. So that's why a prasangika can say, hey, there were arhats. They realized the same emptiness as the bodhisattvas. This is the whole point. And this is trying to show how. That's what Nagarjuna is saying there. Okay. So then the next verse after that one is showing some of the differences, which we talked about before, which is that the bodhisattvas remain in the world out of their great compassion. And so that verse says, bodhisattvas also who have seen it thus seek perfect enlightenment with certainty. They make the connection between lives until enlightenment only through their compassion. So he translates it a little differently. And then it goes on, the next verses, which is 367 through 398, which is 32 stanzas, because right there we were talking about verse 366. So then we went through some of this already, defending the great vehicle scriptures as the word of the Buddha, through arguments that show why the great vehicle is derided and the nature of the great vehicle itself. So I wanted to go through Jeffrey's take on why they deride the great vehicle, because I thought it was a good way to review that again. I read the verses and I gave the outline, but I didn't. He just explains it in his own words here. Why is it derided? A sense of inadequacy and antagonism born of bewilderment about the full extent of the paths and fruits taught in the Great Vehicle. Well, that would make a lot of sense, because if you haven't read those, their own canon doesn't have the full extent of the paths and fruits. It doesn't explain it fully. It explains how to become an arhat, right? And then not identifying the value of altruism and the harm from mere self-concern. Again, arhats who are seeking their own liberation, so they're not really recognizing how that is actually a limitation. And then misidentifying altruism as harmful, because there are some people who just don't buy into altruism. They don't go for it. Or knowing that altruism is beneficial and harming others is bad, but still despising altruism. I don't remember what all that was about. I'd have to look back at the verses. So unfortunately, Nagarjuna then in the next verse says, and I think he's now talking to the monks and trying to say, hey, you're making a mistake if you deride these, you know, because the results of that are rebirths and lower realms. And then he kind of pushes, like, come on, you guys, you don't want to bear these hardships. Like, they can't bear to think about taking so long to become awakened. And that's exactly what Venerable Chodron said about her trip to Thailand when she was doing research on her book in the Theravada monasteries. They just thought, why would you want to spend so long doing this? They just had no interest. So that's kind of right in line with what her experience was. Okay. So, you know, then, you know, it starts to make more sense to me when they teach the part about the six perfections now. Because when I look back after going through this, then I can think, oh, yeah, merit and wisdom, you need the whole thing. Because the next verses, some of the last verses in here, I think it's like 394 and 396, where he said, talks about first you teach students the alphabet, right? Just so the Buddha taught trainees first doctrines that they could bear, you know. He first taught doctrines to turn people away from ill deeds. Then he taught some ways to create merit. Then he taught some doctrines that were based on duality. Things are real. and then some based on non-duality, and then to some what is, he taught, what is profound and frightening to the fearful, having an essence of emptiness and compassion, the means of achieving unsurpassed enlightenment. So this is it. Gelsop explains this in a way that I thought was quite nice. His verse, he says, just as a grammarian first has students read a model of the alphabet, the Buddhists do not teach trainees from the very beginning doctrines that are difficult to realize. Rather, they teach doctrines that they can bear as objects in their mind, things that we can handle, right? So he then lays out the stages. To some, they teach doctrines that turn them away from ill deeds, such as killing. So this is so that these trainees who have the thought patterns of beings of small capacity may achieve the ranks of gods or humans as a fruit of their merit. So that's the person's thought patterns. This is what, you know, what they can bear and what they need to help them to turn, go in the right direction. Then the next step, to some trainees who have the thought patterns of beings of middle capacity, they teach doctrines based on duality of apprehended object and apprehending subject. There's me, there's the object, you know, subject, object, they're dual. And that cyclic existence, one pointedly is to be abandoned and nirvana is to be achieved. This is like what Vaibhashika and Sautantrika, this is what how things are taught. They use the word real a lot. I was teaching on the Eightfold Noble Path from Bhikkhu Bodhi's book, and I actually had to ask him when he was here last year about the way he used the word real. You don't ever see that in a Madhyamaka text. You know, it's just, what's real, you know? It's pretty funny. So yeah, Vaibhashika and Sautantrika, they really, really bring home the point of renunciation and how to get out of cyclic existence, that you need to do that. But they're doing it within a context that the person can handle, like there's a real me and there's a real this and a real that. And so that's how they teach that. Then to some trainees, they teach ultimately established consciousness. Now this is the mind only he's describing. To some trainees, they teach ultimately established consciousness, empty of a difference in substantial entity between apprehended object and apprehending subject. So that's a kind of doctrine that's not based on duality, because there's, remember, in mind only, there's no external objects. It's one latency that rises in the mind is what is creating all this. No external objects. No, there's no dualism there. But there is ultimately established mind. The mind is inherently existent, in their view. They don't really reject inherent existence. That's not the problem. That's not the thing to be negated for them. And then for Madhyamaka, those trainees of highest faculties who will achieve unsurpassed enlightenment, they teach the doctrine that has the essence of emptiness, the profound mode of subsistence of phenomena, frightening to the fearful who adhere to the true existence of things. And they also teach compassion. So this is how in Tibetan Buddhism they always explain this, that there's different dispositions of beings and you have to teach in different ways, and that's why the Buddha taught these different things. It makes sense, because the Buddha did teach these different things, and why would he? Well, you know, when you see, you know, when you have your own experience with these and you meet others, you kind of see, wow, this makes sense. It's like that thing, go left or go right, when you're on that, you know, when you're on that, what do you call that? A trail that has a ravine, you know, a big slope on one side and a big slope on the other side. You're going like that, go right. And you're going like that, go left. You know, they don't, which one's right? Which one's which way you're going? Okay, so I think I explained that as best as I could. Then the whole thing goes on in these later verses, talking about how we shouldn't despise it. And then it goes into a part, this is 390 through 393, incompleteness of the paths and fruits of the great vehicle. That to me is very compelling, that the things weren't explained fully. And that goes into this verse, 393, I think it is, where the outline says that the Buddhahood can't be achieved through practicing just the Four Noble Truths and the 37 Aids to Awakening. And this is a whole thing that Venerable is taught about and is going to be teaching about soon. A lot of this stuff is in the first series book. When I was proofreading, a lot of this stuff was in there. It was interesting. So, and why is that? Why is that that that's not enough? Because their view in that, even if you have the realization of emptiness of inherent existence, in those Four Noble Truths, in the 37 Aids to Awakening, those will only clear out the afflictive obscurations and you'd become an arhat. They don't have the full practices to lead to full Buddhahood, to get rid of the cognitive obscurations. They don't have all the things about bodhicitta and the bodhisattva deeds. And you need those. So they don't have all the causes. Now, to me, that's compelling as a reasoning. You don't have all the causes there, and it fits. Even when I look at the fact that they acknowledge it, that in the Pali Canon, it's acknowledged that they're bodhisattvas. Of course, they accept Buddha. They accept a bodhisattva vehicle. They just don't explain it. Well, it was explained elsewhere. So then, just to close, this is maybe a little long, but I think it's so interesting what His Holiness has to say about this. And Venerable talked about this quite a bit, here and there. So this is His Holiness' take on the authenticity of the Mahayana scriptures. So there were these councils that happened after the Buddha passed away, and he's saying that at the first council, there was no mention of the Mahayana or the Vajrayana. And that's, I think everyone accepts that. But and they weren't widely known, so that doubts were later raised about their authenticity. And he says that he's fully convinced that the Buddha taught the Mahayana and the Vajrayana. And of those, the greatest of the sutras is the Prajnaparamita, the wisdom, perfection of wisdom sutras, because they explicitly teach emptiness and they implicitly teach the bodhisattva paths and stages to awakening, the things that you need to become a fully awakened being. So then, the story is that Nagarjuna, went down to the land of the Nagas to retrieve these sutras. And apparently he doesn't fully believe that, but he also can't deny it. But on the other hand, there's people that believe that those sutras and other Mahayana scriptures were made up later and then attributed to the Buddha. And to him, those are both extremes, two extremes that he essentially doesn't follow. That doesn't really work for him. I'm kind of in his camp. I really believe that the Buddha taught these when he was here, myself. And actually, one thing that's starting to support that even more is in the last 20 years, they're finding more and more really early Mahayana scriptures that are going back much farther than they knew about before, much earlier. So that's helping to support that view. So then as you might recall, Venerable was telling us how His Holiness he has a lot of faith in Nagarjuna. I know this from listening to him speak a number of times. So he talked about Nagarjuna, and Venerable relayed this to us, that how Nagarjuna was born in South India. He had visited Bodh Gaya. He had lived in Magadha at a learning center, which are in northern India. He traveled extensively, and as she said, he must have come in contact with these Perfection of Wisdom sutras, and he began to gather them. And he was also a Sanskrit scholar and a very outstanding monk. As such, he would never lie. And so he knew that people doubted the authenticity of the Mahayana teachings. That's clear from his writings. He's defending them, So he investigated it, and he decided that they were authentic. And His Holiness believes that since Nagarjuna lived only a few centuries after the Buddha, it would have been easier for him to research and establish the validity of the Sanskrit sutras than it is in our time. So having done this research, Nagarjuna was convinced that they were the Buddha's words. And how do we know that? He just told us in his own words, hey, these are the Buddha's words, and this is why. And he taught it in other places too. So His Holiness said that those scriptures were on the verge of extinction, and that Nagarjuna because of that, Nagarjuna propagated them so that people would know about them, which is also what Jeffrey taught us about. I think he listened to some of those teachings when he talked about Nagarjuna. He gave Jeffrey, or Guy Newland, I mean, gave a long series of teachings about Nagarjuna and about his history. And so, let's see. He feels that there were not that many human beings alive at the time of the Buddha were ready for these teachings, essentially. And so they were just a small group passed down from teacher to student and not known to the general public for many centuries. As was, you know, the Vinaya and some of the general sutra teachings were passed down orally, but he believes that the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras may have been written down pretty early. His belief, because there's a whole, you know, body of research about when were they writing? When was writing widespread? And it wasn't widespread at the time of the Buddha, and even right after that. But it wasn't that there was no writing. It just wasn't widespread. He feels that some monks must have known how to read and write. But that because there were so few people who knew about these teachings, that they became very obscure. So that Nagarjuna, when he came into contact with them, he reproduced them and disseminated these. That's pretty much what I think Guy taught as well. So another thing he said that was interesting to me was he thought that it would have been impossible if the Buddha existed the way it's taught in the Pali Canon, that he was unenlightened and became enlightened in that one lifetime. He thought it would have been impossible for him to deliver teachings at such high level. So another thing he talks about is that, let's see, I think we covered that. That, you know, how there were three turnings of the wheel, right? Three turnings of the Dharma wheel. So only in the first one, it's kind of like what I explained, what Gelsip Jay said, taught essentially how to avoid harm, how to generate some merit, how to have renunciation. But really, the more extensive teachings on emptiness came in the second turning of the wheel. And then even more in some of the Bodhisattva deeds teachings were there, but even those were also in the third turning of the wheel. So those weren't in. He didn't explain in the first turning the Bodhisattva deeds. They're not in there. Venerable went through that, the things that weren't in there, like all of the great aspirations that we make and things like that. And then he says, this is not something that she said, but I read it in this new series book. He said, if the Mahayana Sutras were not the Buddha's word, it would mean that the complete instructions for the Bodhisattva path don't exist in our world. See, that's the thing that makes why this reasoning makes sense to me. It's because how do you become a Buddha if you don't know how to do it? You know, you need all the causes and conditions. According to the way we learn about the six perfections, they are the complete path. They contain everything. All the merit and wisdom that you need to become a Buddha is contained in the six perfections. So for him, and I think this really goes back to the first thing I read, like when I said we're steeped in this view, this is where you can see this in His Holiness. He holds Nagarjuna in high regard, and he's using the wisdom of Nagarjuna to guide his own understanding. And so in that, I think the other thing that I only talked about a little bit was understanding what the capabilities of a Buddha were and what the causes were touched on in this. That's really, I think a real salient point for accepting the Mahayana as well. If we understand the vastness of what a Buddha is, which is well explained there, the causes, what his capabilities were, then it makes sense that this is where they were taught. I mean, this is where they are taught, and it makes sense that they were the words of the Buddha. What do you think?
Gelsip also comments, if the
think that's really important, because I'm not sure if everyone heard that. It's important not to despise the great vehicle. Basically, one of the really key teachings that we're taught is when we don't understand something, don't reject it. Just put it on the back burner. And our minds are so obscured that if you just, things that come up that we can't understand, that's going to happen a lot because we can't understand all this stuff. But it's a one of the first books, the first book I ever really read as a Buddhist practitioner was one by Dhammakusho's uncle. And this, when I got to the end of that book, he said in it, I am so pleased, it's something to the effect of, I'm so pleased with myself that I've never rejected the Buddha's word. He was a great scholar, Sanskrit scholar and this and that. But he's talking about the same thing. He never rejected anything. Doesn't mean he always understood everything, but he never rejected it. So that's a huge, if you reject something, it's actually, it's really negative karma, but I think of it more in a more immediate way. Like, think about other things that you've rejected in your life. When your mind starts to turn and you can actually accept them, you actually have put a little bit of a roadblock in the way because you've already pushed yourself against them. I find that to be true in my own experience, and I feel that it's better not to build these roadblocks. Just set them aside, know your mind is obscured, and don't worry about them, but bring them back every once in a while. As you, a lot of things make much more sense the longer you practice. And for me, I'm quite convinced that the, of the capacity of the mind, the clarity and awareness of the mind, that makes total sense to me. It makes sense to me that a mind could actually have much more clarity than my mind has and be aware of many more things than I'm able to be aware of. So I just hold that that time will come, and then when I look at these teachings, they'll make more sense. And that's already happened in my practice about things that are more mundane, but there were things that obscured to me. You know, just like I was saying the other day, I didn't recognize pride or jealousy in my mind. I couldn't figure out how to work with certain situations because of that, because I didn't even recognize it within myself. I hadn't been taught, culturally more taught to have these things, and thus couldn't recognize them even or work with them in a way that felt right. You know, it was always a source of suffering. So that's just like that's an example of that. It's just that it's the level of what we're talking about here. I'm not sure if I'm making that real clear. So what do you think? Yeah.
I just like how you were trying to get us to think about the audience of time, and it just made me think, wow, there must have been a very raging maybe debate that maybe got to the king's ears, or maybe the famous monastics propounding a different view. Mm-hmm. So I'm just imagining he had to step in some way to protect the king, maybe to protect the king's mind, or even politically, like to protect the Mahayana orders.
Yeah, it makes more sense now to see why it would be in that chapter too, from what you're saying.
Yeah, I was thinking about how, I don't know if Venerable brought up this example when she was teaching it, but like in some Buddhist countries, the king basically decided to shut down some orders.
Right.
Like,
oh yeah, like, Sri Lanka.
Like, okay.
Yeah, she did bring that up in Sri Lanka. Yeah.
So maybe that ties in with the policy.
Yeah, because he could do that.
Shut down some temples.
Yeah, so give him all these reasonings about why, whose ear he should listen to and why.
Keep them all open.
And give him reasonings for it. So I do see these more, from the time I started this topic to now, I see the reasonings they hold more to me. But again, they still build. I still can't quite start there. I have to kind of see the whole thing before it all makes sense. And that's what I find in these texts a lot of times. You know. That's why, you know, we learn them slowly, 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 but sometimes I find it helpful to look at a big chunk altogether and see what's happening here. Because when the detail that we go in on each verse, sometimes I lose the big picture. So I really would encourage you to look at the outlines for these texts. It's tremendously helpful. This outline is probably 6 pages. It's not like it's short. It's single-spaced, going, leading you through. Anything else? Yeah.
Would a modern day Theravada practitioner agree with this explanation of extinction and not arising?
I have no idea. No idea. That verse is, I think, seems kind of obscure to me. I've never heard that verse before. Yeah, I don't know. The one thing you can say is that there's a practice tradition and then there's your tenets tradition. So even us who are, you know, in the tradition we're practicing in, if we looked at what our tenets are, we haven't really usually gotten even to Vaibhashika yet. So, you know, there definitely are Theravada practitioners who probably have all different tenet systems, even though they're primarily immersed in, you know, other ones, but doesn't mean that that's all they...
So I guess the ones that, in terms of tenets, are prasangika and yamakas would agree with that one.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the other ones...
Yeah, and, you know, if you buy into this theory that you have to realize the absence of inherent existence to become an arhat, and you believe there were arhats, then there were arhats who realized the absence of inherent existence according to the prasangika view. And there's a number, you know, like Guy has taught on this, and they've written some books on this where they pull out these various verses that, and Venerable's taught on that one by the Kuni, I can't remember her name. Vajira. He talks about the cart and all that. It's kind of like the sevenfold analysis, kind of reminiscent of that. And there's others. And, you know, he brought up that a couple places. So, you know, maybe though they just used one reasoning, that's another big difference. Because if you're going to teach others, become a Buddha and teach others, rather than just liberate yourself from your afflictive obscurations, then you need a lot of reasonings. Because you're going to work with people of all different dispositions. Okay. Oh, yeah.
Also, just referring to your question, it reminded me of last year, Venerable did a book launch in Singapore, where she was speaking with Bhante Dhamma Ratana, I think, from Singapore. Someone asked about, you know, whether they believe that at Nirvana the aggregate sees.
Oh, yeah.
And he actually said, it was so funny how he handled the question, because he mentioned that he kind of hinted that that is kind of the party line, but that he personally didn't believe that. And he's like, that's a tricky question, and like to him it didn't make sense that the line would cease. And
yeah, you know, I think we should go back and listen to this, but 1 year, I think it was when we had Monastic Life, we did a phone conference with Bhikkhu Bodhi. I think that's the year that we talked to him about this. I recall that he said not much was taught about that in the Pali Canon. Not much was said about that. So there is that view, but how widespread it was, you know. I mean, it's certain that not everyone believed that. In fact, I just read that part in Venerable's new book where she talks, Ajahn Mon didn't believe that. He saw Buddha's bodhisattvas in some of his visions or something. You know who he was? Yeah. Became an arhat. What would that be? 1900s? 1900s, yeah. Okay, won't we dedicate? Yeah, sorry.
There's another comment from an online participant. Yes, so he says, understanding and realization is like breathing. Understanding is an in-breath, and the realization is the out-breath. If you breathe in, at some point you have to breathe out.
Mm. Thank you. Let's make our dedication. So let's dedicate the merit from this to all beings. We can think in particular about the beings, the people in Iraq and Mosul and Syria, places of conflict, and unrest and uncertainty and suffering. Wishing circumstances to change and then doing things to make that happen in the way that we can in this very life, this very time. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezig, may you stay until samsara ends.